I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive. writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Danny Snelson, editor of Ubu Editions at UbuWeb, contributing editor to Penn Sound, and that's understating it, curator of the innovative edit series here at the Writer's House, reissues editor at Jacket 2, who has blogged and archived under the title J. Henry Chunko and otherwise, writing, sounds, digital ephemera, etc., etc., whose middle name must be etc., and Jenna Osman, whose books of poems include An Essay in Asterisks and The Character, who appeared in Good Company in the 2002 Best American Poetry selected by Robert Creeley, and who, with Juliana Spahr, co-founded and co-edited the great literary magazine Chain, and whose recent book is The Network, where she, in the words of one reader, quote, subjects American history to a rhizomatic genealogy, unquote. Who was that, Jenna? Do you know? I think it was Michael Davidson. Great phrase. And by Jonathan Monroe, author of a number of books, including A Poverty of Objects, The Prose Poem and the Politics of Genre, and co-author of Poetics of Avant-Garde Poetries and Poetry Community Movement, whose verse and prose poetry, short fiction, and cross-genre writing have appeared as well in numerous magazines and journals, and who traveled to be with us here from Ithaca, New York, where he has long been associated with comparative literature and with writing and rhetoric at Cornell University. Jonathan, thanks for making the trip.
It's always great to be back with you, Al, at Kelly Writer's House.
So how many times have you been to the Writer's House? Three or four, maybe, at this point?
A half dozen, I think.
And this is your first time on Poem Talk. We're glad you're doing it. And Danny and Jenna, welcome back to Poem Talk and to the Writer's House for the nth time.
Thank you, Al.
Thank you.
Our poem today is Joan Retallack's Not a Cage. Most of us first read this poem in How to Do Things with Words in 1998, but it has been republished in a book, Procedural Elegies, Western Civ Continued, published by Roof. It was written in the fall of 1990. Penn Sound's Retallack page has two readings of Joan reading this poem, one for Alden Nielsen's Incognito Lounge in 1991, and another during a reading at Buffalo in 1993. We're going to hear the Buffalo version, so here now is Joan Retallack reading Not a Cage.
The next thing that I'm going to read is a poem dedicated to John Cage, which is called Not a Cage, which is based on first and last lines from books that I was discarding or selling or giving away, I think as a way of assuaging my guilt for not having read them. I collected the beginnings and the endings. Scientific inquiry, seen in a very broad perspective, may see foot, 1957, also Wettermark, 1906, chapter 13. To man seek, the world is twofold, in accordance with that witness is now or in the future. It wasn't until the waitress brought her Benedictine and she, Villandry, Les Douves, Parazet, Lorido, mine, yours, Cynthia, not a building, this earth, not a cage, the artist, disciple, abundant, multiple, restless, a forgery, Opus, Leonis, Bellini, we named you, I thought the earth is possible. I could not tell to make live and conscious history in common and wake. You find yourself among. And wake up deep in the fruit. Did you get the money we sent? I smell fire at full volume, stage dark. One, Russia, 1927, God say your prayers. You were begotten in a vague war, sidelong into your brain. In letter 3 and 4, as earlier, the narrator is North Dakota, Portugal, Moorhead, Minnesota. The lights go down, the curtain opens, the first thing we gun, Veronica wrote, the end, Wittgenstein. Tomorrow she would be in America. Over 40 years ago, a tense, cunningly moving tale by the hung, then he moved on, and I went close behind. Interviewers. What drew a woman from Ohio to study in Tübingen? American readers with this issue, former subscribers to Marxist perspectives, the shadow of the coup continues to hover over Spain. In the ordinary way of summer, girls were singing, like a saguaro cactus from which any desert wayfarer can draw, as is Mr. Fox, but in literature. 25 years have gone by. Ya se digeron las cosas más oscuras. The most obscure things have already been said.
Jenna, when you see the phrase "not a cage" and it's in the title, what do you think? Since we're reading Joan Retallack, or what did you think when you first saw it?
Well, she dedicates the poem to Cage, so it's impossible.
As in John Cage.
As in John Cage,
yeah.
And. It's not a John Cage, but it is, I think, functioning according to Cagean principles. I think that...
How does the word "not" work, then? If it's Cagean, how does it become not a cage? Oh, not a
it's
cage,
it's literally not a John Cage.
Oh, okay. I like that reading. It's certainly a starter reading.
But I think it also speaks to what the poem is doing as well.
Okay, I guess I'm tempted simply to follow up and ask you what it's doing, but I'm going to turn to Danny and Jonathan. So what is it doing?
Well, just to add on, not a cage, I found it actually only recur one more, the exact phrase in The Poetical Wager, just once, where she's describing actually owning and not owning language.
And what's the context?
She's comparing Stevens to Cage's Lecture on Nothing. And in the Cage Lecture on Nothing, she talks about the pure and absolute Cagean artifice, although not a cage any more than an optical lens that helps us focus on a passing scene is a cage.
Interesting.
So it's in that comparison that she, and I imagine working on Cage so much that it would be a tempting phrase to use, not a
right.
cage.
In that case, in The Poetical Wager, she wrote it. Those were her, you know, she did the semantic work. In this case, as we know, the procedure generated a phrase that resonated very well with her and with us as
right.
readers. So, Jonathan, I'm asking a really simple question. I apologize for it, but so why do we, the four of us, let's say, come across a poem called "Not a Cage," find out it's created by a constraint of some kind of procedure, see that the phrase "not a cage" gets generated, and then get delighted by that? Because I can imagine detractors saying, well, it's an accident, so there can't be anything Cagean about that. Kind of a dumb question, but what do you think? I mean, why are we all willing to talk about this?
Yeah, I think your question sends me to the end of the poem, which I thought we might talk about later, But that line, ya se dijeron las cosas más oscuras, one of the things that I'm struck about that is that the translation, the most obscure things have already been said, is of course only one possible translation of it. And I was interested in a translation that would be, that could go they told themselves or they said to themselves the most obscure things.
It's very different.
Yeah, it's very different. And what sends me to that line and that interpretation of it is that I think part of the initial delight that we, the four of us, might get together in noticing that title is that we're all familiar with Cage's work, and so there's a common frame of reference for all of us to talk about the poem. And that common frame of reference, ignites... a lot of thinking about what the poem might involve or what might not involve with the negative. But I was thinking about that line as involving issues of inclusion and exclusion of audience of this poem. And so that's one of the major issues that I come away from the poem.
It's interesting. As a matter of the process here, The Spanish line, and I'm presuming the English line is a translation that she found in Gargoyle magazine in 1988, mm-hmm. is a poem by Ángel González, and it is a book that she was culling from her personal library, as befit the procedure here, and presumably sold or threw out or put in a box in the garage. So it's a discard. So the poem ends with a line, two lines, Spanish and English translation, from a book she's getting rid of. So what are we to do with a poem made of lines from books that the poet is getting rid of? Jenna, I mean, can you start us off here? Isn't that kind of a negative start?
No. I think she's making something out of that, so it's actually a kind of very generative
recycling,
exactly. Mm. I know in previous conversations that we've had about this poem, you've done a kind of reading into what sources were being discarded.
Should I do it again, do you think?
That's up to you. I'll argue with you again.
Why would you argue with me if I started citing the fact that she gets rid of Richard Howard, she gets rid of Martin Buber, she gets rid of Tom McGrath, not a poet you would think she'd be interested in. She throws out some journals like the Socialist Review. I mean, all I can think of is, you're throwing out the Socialist Review? In 1990, this must mean something, and you're going to say...
That's biographical criticism, which is of limited interest here.
Some disdain. Your disdain in the use of that phrase.
Maybe it's Cage.
Well, it's like, I mean, it speaks to the work in the way that John Cage's use of Thoreau speaks to his work, or any of the texts. It says something, perhaps, about his reading habits, or in Retallack's case, her non-reading habits. But in terms of the...
Because she said she hadn't read most of these
yes.
books. Right?
In terms of what the piece is actually doing, I don't think looking at the source work is particularly useful, because... Do you want my Cagean reading?
Yes, please.
I think that what happens when you read this poem is you start paying a lot of attention to enjambments, much more so than the content of the lines themselves. So you start noticing things like there are some like very kind of conventionally lyric enjambments, like "I thought the earth is possible," or to make live and conscious history in common and wake you. But then there are some more surprising enjambments, like "I smell fire at full volume," or "the narrator is North Dakota." And then you have more narrative enjambments, like "what drew a woman from Ohio to
That's
study in Tumagen."
One.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happens in the same way as when in Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds, suddenly you're hearing that the silence is sounding. It's kind of shifting where your attention would go when presented with something, then... The same thing is happening with the line here, where suddenly it's all about how do I get from one place to another, not where am I now in this line.
If I may, I wanted to speak about the enjambments too, and also I think the material construction of the enjambments is really interesting to trace, because she takes all the lines seriously as though they're lineated. So the enjambments of prose works that she's citing, you get the cutoffs, and some of these are very surprising, like "gun," Veronica wrote, "the end," was actually "begun," was the word, but it was enjambed in the prose.
Joan Retallack created the line endings and created the enjambments. She wrote to Rob Fitterman, quote, I didn't change any words or orders of words within the units I drew from the books, that is, the books she was discarding, and lines from which she was writing on a legal pad, from which later she made the poem. But, to continue her quote, "but did decide the length of each. The poem was composed with a combination of chance and intuitive composition on my part."
Which is very related to Misostics, to Cage's Misostics.
It's exactly what he did mm-hmm. in the Misostics.
The question of enjambment, is that more, maybe more of a workshop question in relation to reading this poem than a seminar question? And my question would be more of a seminar question, the kind of hermeneutic question of trying to construct some kind of gestalt of the poem as a whole and an understanding of the poem as a whole. I find a lot with my students in my seminars that they'll light on particular moments in poems or stories or prose poems. And I find myself, especially lately, really wanting to encourage kind of distant reading in a way to kind of back up from the poem and have a sense of the whole within which to talk about a particular moment. So I wonder, given the interest of the enjambment here, does that where do you go, from there in relation to an interpretation of the poem as a whole?
The gauntlet has been tossed.
I know. Wow,
the old seminar
and
workshop.
I totally
divide.
Disagree.
Jenna, Jenna is put into the workshop cage.
Yeah, I was not intending to do that.
It's
but
great.
Just
poem talk at its best. Jenna, I cannot wait, and I know Danny has something to say too. So.
Well, I think if you just consider the works of John Cage, it would be hard to imagine that paying attention to things that you might not pay attention to otherwise is not key. So I guess I kind of reject the distinction between... I think questions of close and distant reading are mm-hmm. certainly useful. I wouldn't say that it's a workshop versus seminar situation, but I think that Cage, at least for me, is very much about close reading or close listening or mm-hmm. listening differently, I guess, is another way to think about it.
Over 40 years ago, a tense, cunningly moving tail by the hung, then he moved on, and I went close behind. Interviewers, what drew a woman from Ohio to study in Tübingen? American readers with this issue, former subscribers to Marxist perspectives, the shadow of the coup continues to hover over Spain.
I mean, being presented with the poem, maybe 1990, before Google Books, and reading it, it evokes like this desire to know what's going on. Like, you get the anecdote, you know what this is coming from, and maybe you recognize some things, like the last line of part one of the Inferno is in here, which is strangely just there because it was in the Chicago Review that she was throwing out a new translation of
which
it.
Which line?
It was, then he moved on and I went close behind. So that's
from the Chicago Review.
Yeah. So which is the last line attached to the first line from Eric Bass's Annihilation, which she quotes from. So for me, as a digital reader now with Google Books, like the strategy of reading, like there's that desire to know mm-hmm. when you would first read this, mm-hmm. but you can know now, and plugging it in and
what
reading all the pages.
What a difference between 1990 and 2011.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the
I think
questions
really
change because when she made this piece, it was a question of what will happen if I do this, what coincidences will occur, what sense will be made that I cannot predict, and now you come across something like this, and the question is where is it from.
Well, no, there's so many more interesting things, right? Like, there's all of the little discrete decisions that she makes. You mm-hmm. can go back and see, like, so she quotes this whole line, but she breaks it in half. What, why did she do that? And mm-hmm. that's really interesting. Like, I mean, even though she takes the first line of some introductions, but she cuts out some introductions entirely and starts from the first line of the prose. So there's all of these really discrete, interesting decisions that still have that kind of,
Let me ask in the most general way, what happened to, let's just say, John Cage's work or Jackson McClough's work, as they and we moved into the computer age, which both, particularly McClough, made lots of use of, and now into the connected, globally connected, or internet age, in which all this thing could be traceable. Does the art, the conception of the art, change? Do we do violence to what was meant? Violence is too strong a word. Is there a fundamental change in the way we behave in relation to these texts, and is that a problem? Anybody have a problem with that? I mean, I'd love to know what John Retallack thinks about how we're doing the Google Books thing with this and therefore having what would be not the same conversation if we didn't have that. Jonathan, do you want to mm-hmm. try that? What changes in this art?
Yeah, well, I liked what Jenna was saying earlier about just raising the question of biographical referent. And just was thinking as you were saying that about I.A. Richards, reaching back to 1922 and the birth of the new criticism as a rejection of biographical and historical kinds of reading. Just thinking in light of your question, Al, about Wikipedia now as almost and digital reading, as you were saying, Danny, has Wikipedia become kind of the new whole? The new referent so that reading a poem like this now, I can imagine, given the obscurity of the references that many readers might feel that it's a kind of treasure hunt, right, where that's the whole game of the poem is, right. is just to go to Wikipedia as many times as you need to, right,
that
to,
last
to find,
line.
Find what the reference are of the, yeah.
That last line is really resonating with me, the way it got translated, with due respect to the point you made about how it could be mm-hmm. otherwise translated. Mm-hmm. The most obscure mm-hmm. things have already been said. I mean, in a way, that's what this poem is. It's a wonderful meta statement, mm-hmm. but also, in a non-meta way, fits it perfectly. Jenna, what are you thinking now? What would be your response to my statement about we do with Cage and McClough? You know, now and forever, we can really micro-scrutinize their process. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem? Is it simply open up new vistas? What's your thought on this? Or we can do the same with you. Your post 9/11 poem, in which you called things from the newspaper immediately after 9/11. I mean, then we may or may not have been able to track it, but now we could probably track everything, all the phrases that you used. Does that make you nervous?
Well, no, I just feel like my response is going to be very similar to what I said already, which is just, I think there are different sets of questions. And I really do think the question that propels McClough, Retallack, Cage, is just what will happen? Trying to set up parameters that, you know, you don't know where it's going to take you. But the current technologies that allow us to kind of very mechanically kind of trace back to source text leads us into this place that's almost prior to that. Like if we could just find the sources, then we can open up all the meaning.
What glee do Danny and I get?
See, I completely disagree. I mean, about opening the meaning. I think, I mean, it's an enrichment, right? I mean, like, or mm-hmm. it's like a pleasure of reading these lines. And I think that the poem really, even in its initial thrust, like, pushes towards that pleasure of sort mm-hmm. of, like, discarding and finding. And as for the historical question, I mean, the text, of course, exists now, right? And the kind of glue historical past, I'm not necessarily interested in getting to that original referent meaning, but lines only exist in relationship to other lines now in all digital spaces, and they only exist in certain degrees of self-similarity.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that Retallack has said about her use of sources is that it's not crucial that you know the sources. However, if one were to follow them, then hopefully they would find really wonderful kind of synchronicities. So there are more treasures to be found.
And in the finding here, we'd be reconstructing the library that she discarded. So there's a certain archival and bibliographical work that is left to be done and can be done now. Jonathan, I want to ask you a question about the introduction that Joan Retallack gives before she read this poem at Buffalo. She talked about assuaging her guilt about getting rid of books. Mm-hmm. I think we all know that a little bit, but it was funny. Was she being ironic, or was there guilt, do you think? And what, if anything, does it have to do with the pleasure that Danny was describing in going back and finding the stuff? But mm-hmm. you think she felt guilty about this, getting rid of her Richard Howard?
I can easily imagine she felt genuine guilt about getting rid of some of these books. Yeah, I can't help but think of Benjamin's Unpacking My Library and the kind of opposite effect of that act of recollection, that there it's a matter of preserving what's considered of particular value at a time when it could all be lost, and the context has changed so dramatically now where there's such an endless amount of material that we all have to process the acts of selection and of recollecting have a very different kind of historical context now than they did then.
Now that we do have Google Books, not only does it allow us to track her sources, but Google Books is also this like incredible source of text that we might never have had prior. You know, like the entire 19th century is there in PDF form. So this idea of collecting books, what it means to have books, what it means to get rid of books, like
there's
that's entirely
no such thing
shifted.
Anymore. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be getting rid of a Google Book? What, a bookmark? You know, you. We could talk about this for a long, long time, but let me go around and ask each of you to just offer one final thought or a remark that you didn't get to say earlier. Danny, you look like you have something to say.
I don't know if this would be my concluding remark, but I'll make it so.
Okay.
I'm interested in the lines also as kind of concordance entries. I mean, of course, she's choosing the first and last line because the middle wasn't interesting enough for her to read, or she wanted to get rid
of it. Isn't it? Yeah, first and last line.
And I think that has
like a cheat sheet.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it has a kind of particular relevance to what you're saying about digital technology now and the way we use literature. So,
great, Jonathan. Final word.
Yeah, I was really interested in reading this text in relation to Edouard Glissant's Poetics of Relation and his statement there, we demand the right to opacity. I think that's one of the major questions that the poem left me with is to kind of recast it in Nietzschean terms, to think of kind of uses and abuses of opacity or of obscurity, and whether that's a pleasure of the text in its own right that we want to claim and without any need to defend it further, or whether we might want to historicize that question of obscurity and opacity and think in terms of different kinds of uses, different historical moments.
Great. Thank you. Jenna?
I think this piece, it was just really nice to revisit the Cagean idea that to be released from familiar logics is very delightful.
Perfect. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world who wants to gather some paradise. Danny, you have something to recommend?
Since we're here, I'd like to plug a student of Jonathan's, Diana Hamilton, whose writings are wonderful and worth seeking out in all corners.
Terrific. Thank you. Jenna?
I'd really like to plug Google Books, especially its 19th century holdings.
Well, what made you referred to that before, but what made you think of this now? I mean, are you working with some of those books?
All the time.
All the time. That's great. Jonathan Monroe.
Well, since we're doing, in the spirit of interconnected plugs, and since Jenna's here, I wanted to mention Sabor a Mi, the reprint of Cecilia Vicuña's book, which I'm teaching later this semester, a really wonderful cross-genre multimedia work of hers that I recommend.
And I'm going to yield my Gathering Paradise time to ask Jenna about her new book, which she's publishing with Wesleyan. Is there a title?
It's called Public Figures.
And
It's further development of a piece that's online at How To, which is about public statuary, primarily in Philadelphia, that are carrying weapons.
That's great. I'm excited to see it. Good luck with the editing and publishing process. Well, that's all the obscure things that have already been said we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Danny Snelson, Jenna Osman, and Jonathan Monroe, and to Poem Talk's engineer, Jeff Borzak, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.